What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal tug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
This is a warning that today's episode of Sisters Let's Talk discusses gender-based violence and sexual assault.
Across the Pacific, there is an epidemic of violence against women and children. In 8 out of 10 Pacific countries, more than half of the women are experiencing violence. That's according to the United Nations. There are some services for women in these countries, such as Family PNG, the Fiji Women's Crisis Center, and Tonga's Women and Children Crisis Center, to name just a few. And these organizations are led by remarkable women who are fighting the scourge of gender-based violence in their countries. But today, we want to ask, what are men doing? Because violence against women is not simply a woman's problem. Men are the cause, and only men can put an end to it. So how do we engage men in preventing gender-based violence? I'm Natasha Metten. Sisters, let's talk about men who want to end the violence. The rates of violence against women in Papua New Guinea are shocking. According to PNG parliamentarians, to end gender-based violence, a woman is beaten every 30 seconds in PNG, and more than 1.5 million people experience gender-based violence every year. Tahina Booth is among the people trying to put an end to this through education, and in her case, sport. She is the founder of the Grass Cat Project, an initiative that uses sport to educate both boys and girls about gender-based violence.
Prior to colonization, we had institutions that guided our people, like our house man and house Mary, as an example. These were safe spaces and places where men and women would come and learn more about life, community, initiation. They would speak about love, loss, how to deal with grief. Mm. And over time, these institutions are either extinct or they've formed into new cultural practices of discussing violence. And I use this as an example in Hela, where I was running a Sport for Peace pilot program. The youth were telling me there that their new version of Houseman is now warlords taking control, you know, of these spaces and plotting who to attack next, who to kill. And this tells us that in PNG, prior to colonization, we had systems that worked, that were peaceful.
Yeah.
And we need to bring this back into modern day life and, you know, integrate it into our churches, you know, integrate it into our families again. Just bring peace back.
And in the modern world, how can we engage men to become part of the solution rather than the problem?
So in my background, you know, using sports, we create safe spaces for men and women to come together and to play sport together. But we also speak on really critical issues around violence. So the organization that I run is called Grasscut Project. And we use sport to engage men and boys, you know, into gender equality initiatives, into listening to women about what happens in their lives. And, you know, for them to realize that they absolutely can change culture within their beliefs. But it's also what we're finding is that our men just want to be heard. They want to be seen. They're hurting as well, you know, and they know that there are some people out there, well, a lot of people out there that do bring harm. But there are many good men that are absolutely trying to flip the narrative. You know, and that's what we're finding when we run our sports programs. We call them community leaders, but these are young men, you know, actively wanting to know how they can make a change, how they can influence their peers. And the best thing about sports, just like music and arts, everyone has a role to play. Every person can participate in breaking down gender stereotypes, in talking about how they can make changes in their own lives and how they can work with women. So through sports, we role model, you know, what this looks like. Girls taking the helm and being, you know, rugby field, for example, being a 5'8" or being the hooker or taking a captaincy role. And we say to the boys and to the men, listen to your captain and work with your captains. We don't get pushback. It's probably just a little bit more confusion from the men and from the boys because they have these sort of, you know, ingrained ideas that women can't play or she's not fast or, you know, she's not as strong as us. But what we've found is that this type of programming enables women to really step up into a leadership position and exercise authority, but do it empathetically. And this is something that the young men see. And when it's done with care and when it's thoughtful leadership, it starts to break down their ideas on what a powerful woman is. We find that the boys are more than happy to play with the girls by the end of our program. And in fact, you know, say, wow, I didn't realize we could score so many more goals with the girls, you know, being in those positions. Yes, they play a little bit differently. They might not be as strong as us, but they play a different game. And it doesn't make it like, you know, a better game. It makes it just a different game. It's really about changing mindsets, you know, in people's safe spaces. And through that, we role model House Mum and House Mary and work with local community coaches, with teachers, you know, with the churches. And the whole idea is that we're creating these safe support systems.
You're describing the 10 Million Strong Leadership Program. Can you tell us more about it and its goals?
There's a bit of history with this particular program. A couple of years ago, you know, I was really looking for a PNG contextualized gender-based violence program. I wanted our people to write it because, you know, of that contextualization of understanding what the cultural norms are. And I couldn't find anything, you know, so I'd consulted some people at UPNG to let's see if we can find something that's either Pacifica or, you know, whatever is out there. We ended up going to Griffith University in Australia and we met Dr. Shannon Spriggs Murdoch, who's an American lady who had written a bystander intervention program, but it was aimed at Pacifica men and rugby league men. And that absolutely blew my mind because she's working at the intersection, you know, of health and also GBV prevention. And that got me super duper excited. We basically said to her, like, you know, we're in Papua New Guinea and we want to work with, you know, this program that you've got. And I mean, can we, you know, we need to make it PNG specific. And we did that over a couple of years, consulted many community members, people living with HIV, women with disability, you know, men rearing children on their own, like really wide community consultations, young people, old people, because it was important that their lived experiences reflected what the curricula was to talk about. And we ran a pilot in 2023 at Badiagua Secondary Technical School. And we found that, one, the delivering this type of curricula, you know, over 10, 11 weeks from 14 years of age is actually too late. A lot of the youths, unfortunately, had experienced very bad violence already. And so, you know, their knowledge of what was happening, we realized we needed to go a lot younger. Another thing was that a lot of the young men, I should say young men, they're still boys, you know, 14 to 19, they had very ingrained belief systems on what a woman's role is, how she should act, what she should wear, that she is absolutely subservient to her husband, that she does not have agency. And that's from 14 years old, you know. And so We were dealing with young kids, really, boys and girls, who the girls knew it wasn't right. The boys were like, well, you know, but that's how it is. And so through the team sports, you know, team sports, through a bit of acting, through drawing, through artistic expression, through games, you know, we used all different types of modalities to engage with the youths. And by the end of the program, what we had seen were, you know, young men visibly not wanting to engage with the girls in activities. By the end of it, we had boys, you know, adolescent boys, standing up for the girls when, you know, somebody would say something not right to them and, you know, say to their peers, you need to listen to her, you know, because she has something to say. Another prime example is that we had parents come up to us and say, when you run the next one, we would like to be a part of it because our relationships with our husbands, we need to have open, honest communication and better communication between us because there's conflict. And this really saw, like, you know, a shift in mindset toward women's participation and leadership. We're seeing, like, you know, these young boys, young men start their own, forming coalitions and standing up for girls and promoting girls into leadership, you know, and that's really important. This next pilot that we're about to roll out is integrating in a more formal sense the role of custom and culture in the programming and, you know, working with more community coaches and parents as well.
And how does it educate men and boys about preventing gender-based violence?
The great thing about sports is that, you know, when you're learning in a group setting, just like when you're passing the footy between, you know, between friends, you're doing it together, you know. So that's the power that we've got. You know, when we speak about breaking down like these gender norms and teaching young boys, young men, you know, the importance of this, like even educating on like talking about rape, we have young men that will start our programs and not realize that rape is criminal. That's pretty full on. And so the fact that they get to learn about this in a group setting is incredibly powerful because, you know, if my friend is listening to what he's saying or what she's saying or, you know, the facilitators is actively listening, then that tells that friend, I better do the same as well. And it's this group mentality. It's a really fast way to amplify key social messages and education. You know, to use sport is actually a really smart investment. If you partner with sport to deliver your key messages and you want to engage youth, young people, and the whole community, sport is such a great way to do that.
Why did you start this initiative?
Yeah, so this is a bit of a trigger warning for anyone. You know, I do speak about things on sexual violence. I was raped when I was very young by someone I knew. And it wasn't until I was a lot older that I was lucky enough to get mental health help because I was not well, you know, growing up. And, you know, I failed school. I wasn't a very good student, but that's only because I was absolutely traumatized. And sport was one of these, you know, activities that really gave me my voice back, gave me my confidence. What I didn't learn in the classroom, I learned in the field. And like, you know, where I am today, you know, sitting on boards, traveling around the world, speaking at different events. But, you know, most importantly, it's working with youth to say, you know, what happened to you is not the end of you. And because of this horrible experience, I've used it to make myself, you know, a much better person. I was lucky to get some mental health help growing up. I've been surrounded by really good people, good support. You know, my mother and my father are, you know, they're my absolute rock. And, you know, I just had to do something in the sports and GBV space. I didn't really know how to get into international development. So I just really carved out my own lane. I started this because, you know, of my experience through sexual violence at a very young, tender age of 7. And I didn't want that to be for my daughters and you know, my daughter's daughters growing up.
Tahina, who are the key people you believe can help change attitudes about women in Papua New Guinea?
It starts at home. It starts with your mother and your father. your aunties and your uncles having these discussions at home and what's appropriate and what's not appropriate, and having discussions with your children about like what's a good touch, what's a bad touch. And in our villages, in our settlements, wherever we live, in our communities, we need to be promoting safety for all. You can't rely on other people to do the work. Everybody has a responsibility to look after our most precious and vulnerable, starting with our children. That work really requires people to understand the power and privilege that they have, you know, and it's absolutely like a privilege to have a child, to rear that child. And we need to be looking after and looking out for all our people. And I think there needs to be more community campaign and awareness, and also access to resources for parents to learn how to look after their children, because these statistics don't lie. You know, the scars on our women's bodies, the loss of limbs, the loss of life, you can't make this stuff up. We need to be taking a really proactive approach and working with, you know, civil societies and grassroots organizations to help them out as much as we can, because they're the ones at the end of the day that are doing the grunt of the work. But, you know, the first things first is speak to your children about body safety. Leaving your kids with your aunties and uncles, like, you know, in our like custom and culture, which is normal, but that's where a lot of abuse happens too. And we need to acknowledge that. And I think we need to be very courageous and brave to start speaking out about some of these things and start reporting real instances of the abuse. Because, you know, I speak to so many people and I sometimes feel like the numbers are actually a lot higher than what's reported, you know, and we know that people don't really report, but it is just absolutely endemic. And you know, we absolutely need innovative approaches to addressing like sexual violence, domestic violence in our communities.
What's your message to men when it comes to eliminating gender-based violence?
You are good men. You are seen. You are heard. We know that you absolutely want to do better and work with women. Don't be afraid to stand up to your peers when you see something that is not right, and challenge your brothers and your fathers to look at it differently. And I know that is actually hard to do, but it's the right thing to do.
You're listening to Sisters Let's Talk on ABC Radio Australia.
You've met Shamima Ali here on Sisters Let's Talk before. She runs the Fiji Women's Crisis Center and is the chair of the Pacific Women's Network Against Violence Against Women. In that role, she helped to develop a set of principles that are being used to train influential men from organizations like the police service and the military to be leaders in gender-based violence prevention.
Wherever we have violence against women and girls, the driving force is patriarchy, and all the gender inequalities, discrimination that women suffer comes along with that. And then in Fiji and in the Pacific, it's further exacerbated by deeply held beliefs around culture, religion, and other things like now we have climate change, the increased use of drugs.
Tell me about the principles that were developed to include men in the conversation about gender-based violence.
The only thing that we are guided by in the Pacific right now in working with men are what we call the Warwick Principles, which is a document that came out of regional organizations, crisis centers and so on, women's organizations, and the men who either of their own volition have started work on men's programs, or who are working alongside women, women's groups and so on, who gathered together. And I think, you know, Papua New Guinea, Vanuatu, Solomon Islands, Samoa, Tonga, and other countries around the Pacific were all present there. Then we looked at all the various, and it was a partnership between the Fiji Women's Crisis Center and UN Women and the Pacific Women's Network. So in partnership, we looked at all the programs that were, and we looked at what are global best practice and what has worked in Fiji. And so the men and the women who were there agreed to certain principles that if we are going to work with men and boys, which is very, very vital in this work, in prevention work on violence against women and girls, that these are the principles that we must adhere to, and these are the principles that we have adhered to with the Male Advocacy for Women's Human Rights Program that was developed by the Pacific Women's Network Against Violence Against Women.
What are the principles outlined in the document?
The first one is being accountable to the women's movement in the Pacific. All programs must be based on women's experiences of violence, discrimination, inequality, and so on. And that women must lead the work on ending violence against women and girls. Men must work with women to be able to do this and you know, following the principles and of how we do this work. The second one, doing no harm. And, you know, while we have men's programs, while it's very vital to prevention work, it also has its risks. The basic principle is doing no further harm because these women and girls have already been harmed. So being grounded in a human rights-based approach, that means it must be, any work that we do must be rights-based. Another one is being evidence-based and continue building evidence. So research, data collection is very, very important, that our work is based on evidence and not hearsay and knee-jerk reactions and so on. Being inclusive and intersectional, which is bringing in everybody, people with disabilities, the LGBT plus community, what we call the minorities, and so on, people who are often ignored, that it is inclusive of that because violence also spread. No one is immune to violence. Being gender transformative, questioning gender power relations, and so on. That's another principle. And looking at the power relations, looking at patriarchy and the gender norms and so on. And being informed by context is the last principle. And that one is about our cultural context, the context of each country, though patriarchy is everywhere. So solutions must come within the context of that country.
How do you apply the principles?
Ours is called Male Advocacy for Women's Human Rights. Mm. And because when men started questioning us while we're doing this work, or there, it was Vanuatu, Fiji, Solomon Islands, Papua New Guinea, some men would say that, I don't beat my wife, I don't rape women, but this work looks good. We want to be part of this. Why don't you make men? So that is a good thing because they themselves want to come in, you know? And so we said, well, how we teach the women, we'll teach them. And, you know, sometimes also people say, men will only listen to men. We say the first stage of the training is by women who have worked in this area, who have got a proven track record, that you start listening to us here. And then it has worked. And then the second one is masculinities, and that can be carried out by men well-trained in masculinities. Then there's another third stage. Out of that, we've got out a handbook, which has a job description for a male advocate and so on. And, you know, basically, male advocates have to change themselves first, look at their own behavior. So the first week of training is about a lot of introspection, change their thinking around women, patriarchal thoughts and so on, believe that women are their equals, equal as human beings. And so on, respect for women and so on. Then they influence change in other men, in their sphere of influence. Like, for example, the people that we pick out for the first trainings are people from the religious, you know, the religious leader, very important in our context. The traditional leaders, very important, youth leaders, policymakers, police, very important in this work. And also we've had military people, people who have influence, people who have power, so that they change their own behavior, then influence other men. But they also help out in organizing workshops, inviting women's groups, supporting funding for women's groups, not taking all the funding for themselves from the women's groups and so on. It's hard work, but it has worked in Fiji. We have some of the best male advocates and people who come from other countries. They are amazed at what we have done here. When we were going to Papua New Guinea, people said, you're going to get chased out of there. And we have done many of them in Papua New Guinea. Many male advocates are there, and the women are also working with men.
Shamima, where are these training programs being run?
Some of the countries from the Pacific Women's Network, they are doing it themselves. They have got their own trainers that have been trained by us. And leaders like Melitahi in Vanuatu and others in Papua New Guinea, Lorio Sisolo in Solomon Islands and so on. So there are women leaders that have come up because the network was formed in 1992. From then till now, you know, this network is still alive and working and new people have come in. So these trainings are done in country on request, or we run a 4-week training program in Fiji. It's called the Regional Training Program on Violence Against Women, Human Rights and Gender. So, you know, so that is for all Pacific people. They find their own sponsorship and come. It's a whole array of things, very interactive, sharing experiences and so on. But then there's also a male advocacy program, trainings that we do in our communities in each country. We do a national, then we go provincial, then we go villages. And now, definitely in Solomon's, in Vanuatu. Vanuatu is very well ahead in this. We've got committees against violence against women. So when we enter a community, we get together people. First the women, always first the women. 5-day training on all of this. And then understanding the dynamics, the experiences, the law, what does the law say, policing, and things like that. Then the men, about 3, 4, 6 months later, we do the men. Then we bring them together. They pick their own leaders. And then we have the committees against violence against women in these communities. So they become then the advocates there.
And how successful have these initiatives been in getting men to speak out against violence?
You know, if they do the right thing, if they've been trained the right way, they have been very, very powerful. And they know a lot of them don't go and, you know, beat the drums and say, I'm a male advocate. They quietly do their work. And women do tell us they feel safer when these men are around. On the whole, most of the men have proven very, very helpful, whether they were in the police force, whether they are in the probations department in social welfare, or whether they are in the judiciary. So these are the kind of men that we have, the people who are, you know, like, for example, I'll give you an example during COVID. When we had domestic violence situations, you know, we had the borders that you could not cross the border. So it happened on the other side of the border. We had traditional leaders or the men of that area bringing down a mother and a daughter who had been raped and no one would help them, brought them down to the, you know, on horseback down to the border. So then we could pick them up from there, put them in isolation, get them the treatment and the justice that they needed and so on. And also reporting domestic violence. One traditional leader would take the hala every morning and, you know, when in the village head goes around telling people what they have to do the whole day, then he'll pass messages of non-violence, don't beat up your wife, and, you know, don't commit domestic violence and all that. So, you know, so those things, then we got reports back of that. So, you know, so little, and then, you know, when you go and do focus group discussions, talk to the children, and the children would say, Mom and Dad don't fight anymore. Mom's not angry every day. Dad spends time with us. That's a big thing, you know, in our traditional communities. And the woman says, nowadays, you know, he has changed a lot. He brings the wood in, he brings the water in, he spends time with the children. Then he goes to drink kava, you know, and the man says, oh, I'm more relaxed with my children. I'm getting to know my children. My wife is not screaming at me that I didn't do this and that, you know, and things like that. So to celebrate those little gains, and then they, you know, and build on those. So, and that's how we work.
What do you think it's going to take to bring an end to these high rates of violence against women and children?
I think that we all need to speak about these things. You know, we are talking about an ocean of peace in the Pacific. How can we have an ocean of peace when our women are suffering in this manner? And then we condone these men and we blame the women for it. So we have all to come together and we have to change the mindset of men. And of women also, women leaders also. So we have to, of society, and we have to speak from the same page. It has to be rights-based. And we also have to look at our faiths and really look at it rather than pick out the misogynistic bits and quote that out of context. Because in the Pacific, that is a problem. When we look at our culture, we really have to have a hard look at it. What culture are we talking about? Pre-colonial or post-colonial culture? And most of the time it's post-colonial because we were colonized by very patriarchal societies. You know, people, the colonizers and so on. Listen to the women. We have a very strong movement on ending violence against women and girls in the Pacific.
Thanks to my guests today, Tahina Booth and Shamima Ali. I hope the men in your life are speaking out against gender-based violence. mindsets can be changed, and it's heartening to hear there are programs in place demonstrating that violence against women and children is unacceptable. Sisters Let's Talk is presented by me, Natasha Metten. Our supervising producer is Kim Lester. Our executive producer is Faleangafulu Inga Stunzna. Sisters Let's Talk is an ABC Radio Australia production. We acknowledge the Yagara, Turrbal and Darumbal peoples on whose land this program is produced. Amtasol na lukimu next time.